Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, August the 2nd. What a horrific night in Minneapolis last night. The interstate bridge crossing the Mississippi River collapsed a little after 6 o'clock, hurling the cars that were on the bridge, backed up during rush hour traffic, on top of each other and into the water. At least 7 people died, at least 60 people were injured, and 20 people are still missing. And authorities this morning will continue recovery efforts, not rescue work, as they do not expect to find more survivors. We are trying to line up some guests who can give us the very latest and to discuss the issues raised by what happened, like the safety of bridges and structural soundness of our bridges. And we will bring you those guests as they become available, interspersed with our regularly scheduled interviews. Our scheduled interview for this hour is someone who may be able to shed a little bit of light on what happened, because she is a professor of media ethics at the University of Minnesota. But our focus of discussion is going to be freedom of the press and protecting reporters and their sources, and the new federal SHIELD law that was approved yesterday by the House Judiciary Committee. The Free Flow of Information Act of 2007, the Federal Media SHIELD Bill, which would make it easier for journalists to protect the identities of their confidential sources. We'll wonder how important that is to you and to our society in general, from our guest, and we will welcome your questions and views at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or please send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest this hour is Jane Kirtley. She is the Silla Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota. She is also the former executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. And she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how are you near this bridge?
I commute very close to this bridge. And in fact, I was driving home last night just as the collapse, just after it had occurred. I don't go over this bridge, but I'm near it because it's quite close to the university. And I saw a water rescue truck heading over in that direction, and I actually had assumed that it was a much smaller scale problem. We occasionally, as you can imagine, have people jump from that bridge, and I had thought that that was what had happened. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until I actually turned on my Minnesota Public Radio and found out what was going on that I was aware of the magnitude of this incredible disaster. It's really pretty shocking for all of us here.
Yeah, I bet it is. We, by the way, have a call into the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom, and they're trying to find us a reporter, but as you might imagine, they're very busy and have been out all night and are still on the scene right now. So we hope to hear from a reporter from MPR sometime this morning. Now, yeah, this is the bridge that the coverage I've been watching. I've been on that bridge, I'm sure, before.
I'm sure
driving
you have.
Over there. This leads to the University of Minnesota, right?
It goes between, if any of your listeners know this area, it goes between Washington Avenue and University Avenue, which are two thoroughfares that sort of transect the campus. But actually, where this occurred is just on the west side of the campus. And as you probably have heard, this whole stretch of 35W has been subject to construction for several weeks here now. And in fact, the ramp that led to this bridge from the university has been closed for some time. But this particular part of the span, they said, was only being dealt with cosmetic patching and so forth of concrete and so forth at the time. It was not being structurally repaired. At least that's what they're telling us right now.
Right. And what they're telling us now is that they certainly don't know what led to the collapse, but it seemed they were very quick, authorities were very quick to rule out terrorism.
It was interesting in a way that they were, because I was trying to watch really all the television coverage simultaneously, and I noticed that Our local Fox affiliate was really the first one I saw that sort of raised the terrorism issue. And I was a little taken aback by it because it seemed at that point, I mean, this was just a few minutes after it occurred, and it seemed like no one could have been authoritatively knowing anything at that point. But yes, although the FBI has been here investigating, they've said that this is just routine after something of this magnitude and that there's no sign of a terrorism. Some of the eyewitnesses said that they heard a couple of loud bangs before the bridge started to wobble and then collapse, but obviously that certainly doesn't indicate terrorism, and I don't think that there really are any signs of a bomb or anything like that.
Yeah, I know that you weren't invited to be our on-the-scene reporter
No.
for this, but you did have some comments as a professor of media ethics on the
coverage. Mm. Yeah, and again, of course, I was listening to the public radio as I was driving home, and you know, that was very early, just after it occurred. But I thought they were doing, you know, a very fine job. One of the things that I found, I don't mean to beat up on Fox particularly, and in fact, this was one of the other stations. I believe it was the NBC affiliate that made a comment about the fact that one of the spans of the bridge actually fell onto a freight train, and they were saying that one of the underneath the concrete that had fallen there was a tanker, and said this tanker could be full of gas, or it could be full of some other liquid, or it could be full of some dangerous substance, and we don't really know what it's full of. And, you know, my reaction to that was, well, then let's not speculate at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, let's try to find out what it contains, and if it's posing a danger, let's say so. If it's not, then let's say that too. If we don't know, let's just make that observation. But it just seemed to me to be an unnecessary commentary at that stage. But having said that, I was actually found that the local coverage was very good. There was one comment, and again, you know, in the heat of covering breaking news, I don't want to be overly critical, but someone was making a comment about rescue workers frantically working, and I saw no signs of anything frantic. In fact, I think frantic and Minnesota don't really go together.
Yeah.
I thought it was extremely professional and very orderly, and you know, it's a horrible situation, but I was very impressed with the professionalism of everybody that I saw, and nothing on the coverage I've seen has suggested anything other than that in the terms of the way this has been handled.
Well, we'll get to our topic at hand after we check the weather. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 and a half minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, August the 2nd. We are talking this hour with Jane Kirtley. She is the Silla Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota. She is also the former executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. We invited her to talk with us about the new Free Flow of Information Act that was considered yesterday by the House Judiciary Committee. The committee passed the proposal that would shield, it's called a federal shield law, it would shield journalists so they would not be compelled to identify confidential sources or turn over documents except in rare cases. The full House still needs to vote on this, as does the Senate. We're wondering if it should pass or not. Our guest says it should, and we welcome your questions for her at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your questions and views on this topic. And Professor Kirtley, tell us, we actually called the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press to get the group's take on this this legislation, and they said call Professor Kirtley. So what do you think of this bill?
Well, you know, this is a compromise bill. From a journalist perspective, I think that there has, you know, been a lot of resistance historically to enacting a federal shield law. This is, I don't know the how many iteration of some version of a shield law going back to about 1972 or 73, after a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Brandsburg versus Hayes said that there was no First Amendment protection that would shield journalists from compelled disclosure. I think that there have been roughly 100 different proposals since that time. In the last 3 years, we've had about 3 different versions of this this bill introduced. This is the most recent one that was introduced in early May. And it's not an absolute shield law, as you said. It does provide some situations where journalists could be compelled to reveal confidential information and source identity, specifically if the information is needed to prevent imminent harm to national security or death or bodily harm, or, and this is, I guess, the parts that bother me the most, frankly, reveal the sources of leaks of trade secrets of significant value, identifiable health information or other personal information, financial information that was revealed in violation of existing laws. These were additions that were put in by some business groups, and frankly, they are new. They are not something that had cropped up in previous versions of this law. And I guess that's always the risk with a statute like this, that various groups that you know have see themselves as having a dog in the fight will try to basically water down the law to protect their particular interests. But this issue about national security was a major sticking point during the negotiations on this bill. There were several members of Congress, particularly but not exclusively Republicans, who had been very concerned that this law could be used even by representatives of terrorist groups to use it as a justification to not testify in court proceedings and so forth. But I think that argument has been overcome in large part because the definition of who is covered by this law would seem to preclude someone like that. Although one of the sponsors, Rick Boucher of Virginia, has said that the law would indeed cover bloggers, it would not cover someone who is not engaged in journalistic activities.
Yeah. So a blogger is considered a journalist?
Well, this, again, was a huge argument in earlier versions of this bill. Back when hearings were held a year or so ago, there were several members of Congress who said, you know, that using the classic line, you know, I don't want some guy in his pajamas with a computer and a modem being covered by this law. But what it speaks in terms of, and I think that this was a good way to handle it, is rather than speaking in terms of a formal affiliation with the mainstream media, it simply says that someone who's a covered person is someone who is engaged in journalism, and journalism means gathering, preparing, collecting, photographing, recording, writing, editing, reporting, or publishing news or information that concerns local, national, or international events or matters of other public interest for dissemination for the public. I mean, that reading to me would not only include bloggers, it would include some of the people that were at the bridge yesterday with their cell phones taking pictures and then sending them on for distribution.
Mm-hmm. Now, would this federal shield law, as passed by the House Judiciary Committee, would this have prevented, say, Judith Miller from going to jail for refusing to identify her source in the Valerie Plame case?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because there's actually been some debate about that in the course of these various versions of the bills going through. There were arguments made that, in fact, they would not have necessarily protected not only Judith Miller but some of the other high-profile people like Jim Terracani of Rhode Island, who was put under house arrest a few years ago for criminal contempt. But again, I think that the question in the Judith Miller case would have been whether this would have fallen under her information would have fallen under the category of national security, causing imminent harm to national security. I mean, my interpretation would be that it would not. But again, there's also a provision that says a criminal investigation or prosecution, reasonable grounds to believe a crime occurred, and that this information was essential to the investigation. You know, what crime in this case? Were we talking about a breach of national security, or were we talking about, you know, somebody's perjury? You know, a lot of these questions will, if this law is adopted, ultimately be decided, I'm afraid, in the courts.
Yeah. Now, this area that says that reporters can't protect sources when it comes to, like, if trade secrets were revealed.
Yes.
Would that mean that, I don't know, a whistleblower for Big Tobacco, the insider, a reporter couldn't protect a source like that?
Well, there has been concern that that would be the way the law would be interpreted. I think, you know, some of your listeners may be familiar with the fact that there was a case out, that arose out in California a couple of years ago involving revelations of trade secrets involving Apple computers on a website. And there was actually a lawsuit brought by the computer company to try to compel the revelation of the names of the people that were had leaked that information to this website. I mean, that's kind of the classic situation, I think, that we're talking about rather than whistleblowing. But, you know, the definition of trade secret has been pretty malleable and sometimes pretty broad. Apple was arguing, you know, trade secrets. It was a slightly different situation because they were trying to get the Internet service provider to reveal the name of the people that, that were involved as well as the sources. And there is a provision dealing with that in this bill as well, in terms of whether so-called communication service providers are required to reveal the names of people that are posting. And there's a multi-tiered process that you have to go through, and one of them is that you have to provide notice to the individual, the journalist or whoever, that this information is being sought to give them an opportunity to come in and resist it rather than the ISP just turning it over. This, again, is... This is really not a new concept. It's something that already exists in another federal law, but I think it's being dealt with very specifically here because the topic has come up in a couple of cases before.
We have a couple of callers and almost time for a news break. Let me bring in Tori in Maguanago. Hi, Tori. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I have a question for you specifically about, well, in regards to what you guys were talking about. Well, shielding the media, you know, there's really a fine line between what's truth and what's false. As soon as anything happens throughout my life, I'm about 33 years old right now, I've seen, you know, as soon as something major happens, everyone jumps all over it like a bunch of flies. And whoever can get the story first out there, you know, obviously, you know, they're going to get it out there as quick as possible for social recognition. And, you know, I mean, there's a fine line between, you know, protecting what's private and protecting what should be public. So, I mean, I don't know the specific details of the bill that's going to be passed, but like I said, there should just be a real, real fine line between, well, let's jump all over this, or let's wait for a second, you know, because there's some personal issues here.
Yeah, there's a protecting an anonymous source of a reporter, Tori, not necessarily jumping all over something.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a law dealing with privacy. You know, there are already laws that deal with that, both court law and some states' statutory law. This is also not a law, you know, to make the media tell the truth. This is a law that is, if it's enacted, that would protect the right of journalists to not be compelled to disclose sources of confidential information, sources that they have not revealed because the source has indicated that if their name is made public, there's going to be retribution of some sort. I mean, that's what it's intended to protect.
Yeah. We're going to check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we'll continue talking with Jane Kirtley, who is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, talking about the federal media shield law that passed the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 6:36 on this Thursday, August the 2nd. We are talking this hour about a new proposed federal shield law for journalists that would not compel them to identify confidential sources or turn over private documents, except in rare cases. It's called the Free Flow of Information Act, and it won committee approval yesterday in the House Judiciary Committee. But its prospects in the full House and the Senate are less certain. We're talking about whether this Freedom from Free Flow of Information Act is needed, is a good bill or not, with our guest, Jane Kirtley, the Silla Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota, former Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, and we welcome your thoughts and questions and whether you think this is a good idea or not. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Professor Kirtley, we were talking about what's in this bill and what's not. It sounds like you're not exactly thrilled with it. Even with the flaws, though, you think it should pass?
Well, here's the reality. In the last few years, we've had a real increase in the number of subpoenas that have been served against the press in criminal investigations. And there are a number of reasons for that, but quickly, I guess I would say that there are two main ones I would point to. Number one, the Judith Miller case led to a number of court decisions in federal courts in Washington, D.C., where a pretty influential federal court was very skeptical about the existence of any kind of constitutional privilege. Now, this is significant because in the years since the Brandsburg decision in 1972, a lot of federal courts had recognized what they called a qualified privilege in situations other than the narrow situation that had presented itself in Brandsburg. So we lost a lot of ground, I guess, over the Judith Miller case in terms of legal precedent. So there's that factor. It's going to be much harder now to argue that there is a constitutional privilege. So the alternative to that is a statutory one. The other factor is that the Department of Justice in the last few years has seemingly been deviating from a standard that they had used for many, many years, guidelines issued by the Attorney General's office that basically said that subpoenaing a journalist should be the last resort. It's more complicated than that, but that's the bottom line. Attorney General Gonzalez and others in the Justice Department, although they continue to say that the guidelines are being followed, the evidence would seem to suggest otherwise, because the number of subpoenas that have emanated from the Justice Department and its agencies has gone up. This has been documented statistically. So I think when you put these two factors together, the bottom line is that in the federal courts there is now more use of subpoenas against journalists. Having a law like this would hope abate some of that.
Our next caller is Tim in Nixonia. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hey, I was just wondering if working papers are specifically addressed in this bill.
What the bill talks about is production of both testimony and documents. And what it says is that if somebody's trying to compel production of documents, and you know there's a number of ways to define that, I suppose. Then this number one, in a criminal investigation or prosecution, there has to be a belief that a crime has occurred and that the testimony or the document is essential to the investigation or prosecution or to the defense. And that it's essential to this proceeding. If the document would reveal a confidential source, then the whole confidential source analysis of imminent harm and all that would come into play. If it doesn't, then the qualified privilege is simply dealt with on this idea of reasonable grounds to believe that the crime has occurred and that it's essential to the case. This is really a codification of the so-called qualified privilege that has existed, again, for over 30 years. And it's predicated on the idea, essentially, that if you are serving a subpoena, it shouldn't be a fishing expedition. It should be essential to the case. It should be unobtainable from some other non-media source, which is often, of course, not the case. Usually journalists are an easy way to get information, but they're usually not the primary or the only reason. Essential to the case and, really, really critical material to the nature of the prosecution itself. So the answer is yes, documents are covered by this law.
Thanks, Tim. Mark in New Berlin, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I tend to like the idea of the bill, and if we lived in an ideal plane of existence, it would probably be a good thing. But I don't see any balance either. Though it seems to me that journalism, whether it be print or televised stuff, has become very polarized, and in many cases, these journalists or the organizations they support have become virtual arms of the of one or the other parties. They become almost agents of the political party rather than journalists. It's hard to say that I wanted to give them any more rights. They tend to make up news. I look at the 60 Minutes stuff. They become biased. They give recommendations on who to vote for, which is really free advertising. It doesn't have to be reported.
I'm sorry, Mark. It sounds like you just don't like journalism. Is that what?
I don't like what journalism has become in this country. I don't think it is any longer a matter of seeking the truth, reporting the news. I think it's become helping your political party or your philosophical ideas become reality.
What's your reaction to that, Professor Kirtley?
You know, I think a lot of people have frustration with the so-called mainstream media these days, and I certainly do myself on occasion. But I think one of the things that this bill is intended to do and that I think we all could do is to kind of step back and say, we recognize that, you know, back when the Bill of Rights was being drafted, we had a very partisan press in this country. There's no debate about that. If you think the press has affiliations now, you should have seen what it was like in the 18th century. And yet, as Thomas Jefferson famously said, he would have chosen newspapers over government because he recognized that a free press, and as we define it here, a free press is one that is not controlled by the government, was essential to the democratic system. Certainly the First Amendment doesn't guarantee us a responsible press or one that necessarily I like or that you like, but the idea here is that we protect really the ability of journalists to act independently, and that's at the heart of this. And I think the caller is concerned that the press is not acting independently if it has what he sees as political affiliations. The independence I'm talking about here is not being turned into an investigative arm of the government, which ultimately is what these subpoenas are all about. It's the government asking journalists to do their work for them as they proceed with criminal investigations. And, you know, I think that the balance that's trying to be struck in this bill is to say that should not be the default position. It should only be allowed in extraordinary cases where there truly is no other way to get the information, which is a pretty rare case, actually.
Well, the government, in terms of the Justice Department of our government, opposes this bill a lot.
Yes, they have been extremely outspoken in their opposition to this bill, and it's curious because when it was being drafted, one of the things that the drafting groups were trying to do was to, in some senses, just sort of codify the Attorney General guidelines that I mentioned earlier that have been in place for quite a number of years, and even so, the Justice Department was saying no, this is going to cause all kinds of problems. And, you know, to a certain extent, one, I suppose, would expect the Justice Department to say that. They would much rather rely, if on anything, on their own guidelines. The problem with those guidelines is that there's no way to enforce them. Those guidelines don't create any enforcement mechanism where you could go to court and compel the department to follow them. And an attorney general at any time could simply rescind them. So although it's been extremely useful, and I don't want to suggest it hasn't been in the past, there's no guarantee it will be there forever. So I think part of the idea of the statute is to enshrine into code a provision that, frankly, the Justice Department has been following for quite a long time, seemingly without any difficulty at all.
We're talking about the Federal Shield bill that passed yesterday in the House Judiciary Committee. It is for journalists so they can protect their confidential sources in most cases. It passed the House Judiciary Committee, but not sure if it'll pass the full House or the full Senate. We wonder if journalists need more protection in terms of protecting their confidential sources and documents. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We're talking with Jane Kirtley, who is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, former executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us on this Thursday, August the 2nd. It's about 12 minutes before 7 o'clock. Coming up at 7, we'll get the latest news from National Public Radio on that bridge collapse in Minneapolis. We have calls out to various reporters and other guests to join us throughout the morning to give us their expertise or the very latest on the catastrophe that happened last night, about 6 o'clock, a little after 6 o'clock, where the Interstate 35 bridge in Minneapolis collapsed and sent cars into the Mississippi River. At least seven people confirmed dead, about 60 people injured, 20 people still missing. Authorities now are conducting recovery efforts. They don't expect any more survivors. Again, we'll continue to follow that story for you throughout the morning and bring you guests as they become available. Our scheduled interview for our next half hour, we're going to be talking with a state lawmaker who is proposing a new law for Wisconsin to forbid teenagers from driving with cell phones. So that's our topic after 7 o'clock. Right now, we're talking about whether we should be protecting reporters and their sources, talking with Jane Kirtley, who is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, former executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, talking about the new federal shield law, the Free Flow of Information Act, that won approval in the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. It would protect journalists so they would not be compelled to identify confidential sources or turn over documents, except in rare cases. They would have to reveal confidential sources or turn over documents, recordings, and photos if the disclosure is necessary to prevent imminent and actual harm to national security, or if it is necessary to prevent imminent death or significant bodily harm, or, and this is one area that my guest doesn't necessarily agree with, if a person has divulged a significant trade secret or certain financial and health information in violation of current law. We wonder what you think about this federal shield bill, and we welcome your questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our own Republican U.S. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner of Menominee Falls doesn't like this measure very much, Professor Kirtley. He has made statements in the past that with every right comes a responsibility, and that certain elements of the news media have not been responsible in the publishing of information. For example, the New York Times report, I think that was earlier this year, on how the U.S. government tracks money laundering by terrorists through a system in Brussels, Belgium. He didn't think that that ought to have been reported, and presumably the reporter should have to reveal the source who gave him or her that information.
There's been a fair amount of rhetoric along those lines in the last year or two, not just the Swift revelation that you're referring to, but also things like the secret prisons in Europe and so forth, and many of which, of course, won Pulitzer Prizes and other journalism awards. I think significantly, and I guess this is sort of an undercurrent to this, to the extent that the government launches leak investigations, they're generally not directed specifically at the press in the sense that they're seeking to bring criminal actions against the press for publishing or obtaining the information. The argument is all we're after is the person who gave it to you, who broke the law, arguably, in leaking the information and so forth. But the reality is that an investigation like that is clearly going to have a chilling effect on the ability of journalists to do their job and to bring to the public important information. And as we've learned again in the last couple of years, news organizations don't just arbitrarily make these decisions to publish this information. In fact, some of them have been criticized for having held the information for periods of time while they talked to people, made decisions, and so forth about whether, in fact, the public interest in disclosure outweighed the public interest in maintaining the secrecy of the information. I guess my point would be that, that certainly, as in any other trade or business, there are irresponsible elements in the news media, but what we're trying to do here is to protect a principle, which is that the press needs to act independently and have the right to do that. One other point I'd like to make very quickly is that part of the reason for this federal shield law initiative is that it would really bring the federal law in line with the law of the vast majority of states. 49 of the states have recognized some kind of journalistic privilege. 33 of the states plus the District of Columbia have a statutory shield law. And if that state, or so-called state shield law, I guess, in District of Columbia had been applied to the Judith Miller case, she would have been protected. The reason she wasn't was because she was in a federal proceeding. Mm. And so really this is designed to try to kind of level the playing field so that in federal courts we're dealing with at least this a level of protection that is roughly comparable to that that already exists on the state level.
Our next caller is Lenny in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
I got a question for the professor, or first an observation. My observation is that there's way too much power being concentrated in the hands of corporations when it comes to the media. I think when roughly around five people in this country own most of the main media sources that reach you and me, I think that's a problem. I think the FCC is partly responsible for that. Second, I think that the shield law on the federal level is essential to maintaining a free press and preserving the rights of the press not to be abridged. And I think it will bring things kind of back in the balance. I don't like what happened with Judith Miller and the Valerie Flame case. I don't like the idea of journalists being coerced with subpoenas and the threat of jail when they're out there getting the story. And I agree with the professor that it's the government's job to convict criminals and find the necessary evidence it's going to take to put them away and prosecute them and put them away. That's my observation.
Well, thanks, Lenny.
Well, you know, I think that caller kind of reflects the ambivalence that, that many people feel, that, that they look at what's happening to the news media in this country, and certainly many people share the view that concentration of ownership, I mean, the recent acquisition of Dow Jones mm-hmm. by Rupert Murdoch being the most recent example, is a cause for concern. You know, whether the FCC should be taking a more aggressive role is certainly a topic for debate, but I appreciate the caller's comments on the need for a shield law, and I would agree with what he said.
Yeah, we did hear from a couple of callers, though, who seemed to want to complain about the press and journalism. Tell us, Professor Kirtley, what types of stories... why is this important to people other than journalists?
Well, you know, I think the classic example that journalists always turn to is the idea that the Watergate story mm-hmm. would have been very difficult to have told had it not been for confidential sources. Pentagon Papers case, another example. But more recent stories, the Enron scandal, the abuse at Abu Ghraib, the conditions at Walter Reed Medical Center, an amazing series by Dana Priest at the Washington Post, and even a rather controversial case now, a case arising out of San Francisco involving the steroids being used in professional baseball. All of these stories were based on confidential sources.
Yeah, and this type of a press shield law would prevent those reporters from going to jail if they didn't want to reveal their sources. If there wasn't a place, if they couldn't have the confidential sources, they may not have had those stories.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the point. I mean, yes, it's to protect journalists, but I think again, remember the name is Free Flow of Information Act. It's to make sources feel confident that if they talk to journalists, that the journalists will be protected and not compelled to reveal that information.
It's off our topic, but you brought it up. I just on inner final minute, I did see some, I think it was the Free Press or Free Media Group was saying that the Dow Jones acquisition by Rupert Murdoch was a big blow for journalism. Do you feel that?
It's hard to dispute that when Rupert Murdoch acquires a property, it fundamentally changes. I mean, one of the best examples of that from my experience is the Times of London, which has changed radically since he acquired it. There are those who would say that Rupert Murdoch isn't going to kill a cash cow and isn't going to destroy Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal, that would not be serve his purpose. But I don't think that there's any question that people are concerned that the acquisition by Murdoch is going to have an impact on what the Dow Jones publishing company does. Editorially, I'm not sure it's going to change too much. I think what people are worried about is the excellent news reporting that the Wall Street Journal has been known for all these years.
Thank you so much for being with us and for reporting on two other issues besides the one that we asked you to come on for.
It was a pleasure.
Jane Kirtley is the Silla Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota, former Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, talking with us about our scheduled interview on the federal shield law for journalists, but also giving us some on-the-spot commentary about the bridge collapse in Minneapolis. That's where she is, and a little bit on the media coverage of that. And we thank her for being with us. Thanks to Leo Duran and to Christina Taylor for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.